Welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. Wow, I love sitting down with Deanne Smith for this episode. She is the best. I have known her for a very long time, but this is the first opportunity we've got to sit down and, you know, have a chat for 70 minutes. And it's just such a wonderful opportunity to get to know someone better that you've known for a very long time. She's been one of the best, most compelling, interesting comedians to be coming out to Australia for over a decade now. I've got to do her shows in Canada as well. She's such a generous host and creates such a wonderful atmosphere and vibe for comedians to perform in. I really enjoyed this one. You can probably tell in my voice. She was an absolute delight, and I couldn't have been happier spending the time with Deanne. Hey, there's a couple of other podcasts that haven't come out yet. Kitty Flanagan, Jason Byrne, who are both performing at the Comedy Festival as well. So when you hear this, there's only going to be a couple of days left at the Comedy Festival. By then, maybe my Will Eagle shows are sold out already. I don't know. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But I'm performing all weekend up until Sunday. So come and see a show if you get the opportunity. But otherwise, go and check out Deanne, or go and check out Andy Zaltzman, or Kitty Flanagan, or Jason Byrne, or any of the other people who've so generously given me their time to do the podcast. Alex Edelman, go and check out Alex Edelman, his Barry nominated show. Alex was brilliant on the podcast. If you haven't heard that one yet, check it out. The Denise Scott episode, I absolutely loved. Anyway, go through the back catalogue. You can rate it. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of those sort of places. Look for Philosophy Pod in the places that you enjoy things. Sign up, subscribe. That way you won't miss an episode. And yeah, tell people about it now that it's back, now that it's regular. And if you're enjoying it, the best way to keep it regular is to spread the word around, get plenty of people listening. And if plenty of people listen, maybe we can find a sponsor or something which will pay for the costs of actually putting out the show each week. So if not, in the meantime, if you'd like to support us a little bit with this, the best way to do it, of course, is, as always, is to come and see one of my live shows. But if you can't do that and you want to support it anyway, chuck us a couple of bucks at Patreon, patreon.com/tofop, T-O-F-O-P. That's where the Patreon page is for all the Tofop podcasts, Tofop, Fofop, Two Guys, One Cup, and of course this one, Philosophy. So the money that goes there helps to keep the lights on, pay our bills. You know, everyone involved in the podcast gets paid. Well, actually, that's not technically true at this stage, but everyone to do with putting the podcast together, the technical people, Mike and Michael and James, all get paid every episode, and it's your Patreon money that helps support doing that. All right, there you go. That's the intro to this one. I love Deanne Smith. I think you're going to love this interview too. Cheers. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Very excited to have our guest on today. So we've relaunched this podcast. I'm explaining as much to the audience as I am to my guest. I'm giving her some information along the way.
Thank you.
We've relaunched this podcast. We managed to get 12 of them out in an entire year last year, which is what the audience referred to as nowhere near enough. So instead, we're going the opposite direction, seeing there's so many brilliant people that I love here during the Comedy Festival. We've been doing a whole bunch of these, and I'm very excited to have our next guest on. I have known her for a very long time now, and but you know, as the world works, you rarely get to sit down and have, you know, a decent conversation with somebody about, you know, these sort of topics. So I'm very excited to have you here. This is how it starts. What's your name? Who are you? No, what's your name? I got that wrong. It's not even what's your name. The question is, who are you?
Hi, I'm Deanne Smith. When I was a kid, I would answer that question by I'm Deanne Smith, but my friends call me Dee. It's always hard for me to know which name to give. And who am I? Well, the other night, I whispered in an audience member's ear because I thought there were reviewers in the room. And I was like, how are you enjoying the show? But I was feeding them all the lines. And I was like, how would you describe myself? And then I whispered to them, joy manifest in human form. And the best part is they said it. And then the reviewer printed it, even like cheekily, like in quotes or whatever. Right. But I was like, you did it, guys. It's right. In. That's next year's quote. Forget about it.
It's there.
I think that's who I'd like to be. Joy manifest in human form.
I think that's a really apt description. It's rare that somebody can kind of have a nice description for themselves, which is actually also the way that other people see them. Because I think there's often a gap between those two things. But
yeah.
When I look at your work and having known you as a person, it does feel like that is intrinsic to who you are as a human being. And so I'm going to ask you the other question, which is, do you have a particular philosophy towards something? I wonder if the two intersect in some way.
Yeah, just off mic, you said, this is what we're going to talk about. And I was a little panicking about the philosophy because I don't know how to articulate it. And I'm sure I would just say, the main thing that I try to go for or lead myself back to if I forget is just increasing love, approaching things from a place of love and trying to bring love to situations and people. So that manifests in trying to be more empathic, trying to be compassionate, trying to look at things from other people's point of view, and try to be loving towards myself. Like, as much as I said, oh, I'm joy manifest in human form, I'm also just a bundle of anxieties and issues, you know?
So is this a thing that has always been a constant of you? Have you always been a person who's kind of, you know, tried to look on the, you know, the positive side of things, to try to view, to walk a mile in other people's shoes and view it from their perspective? Or is this something that is, you know, developed lately in your life?
No, I think I've always been that way. And I think I would have characterized myself until I did comedy, which I feel like saved my life and is the best thing ever, you know? But I would have thought that I was kind of, I don't know, standoffish or depressed or quiet. But then having done comedy, I can see that what people respond to and how they describe me back to myself, I'm like, oh yeah, you know what? Yes, I do have this bit of like a kid sister vibe, and I am always trying to make people happy, and that comes from a genuine place. And so, yeah, I don't even remember the question anymore.
Well, I just want to explore that idea a little bit more, which is this idea that sometimes people who are trying to make other people happy, it can come from a place of them not being happy themselves. Like the facilitation of other people's happiness, you know, is a replacement for the fact that they can't facilitate their own happiness. But that doesn't seem to be what you're saying about where it comes from for you.
No, I just think, if you have to attach to anything in life, like what is it all about? What does it mean? I always come back to the very cheesy and basic idea of love.
So when you say love, what do you mean by that?
I mean the beautiful feeling you get in your heart when you know that you've done something right, or you've treated someone right, or you've treated yourself right.
Let's talk about treating yourself
right.
We
are so deep in it so early on. This is great. I just like, where are we going to be in an hour?
I know. Well, who knows? Yeah. Like, you know, we'll talk about death at some stage. That'll bring the mood down.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But so loving yourself, firstly, tell me what that means to you.
That's the one that I'm working on the most.
Because I think that's the most difficult one. I mean, as performers, the idea of like loving an audience or receiving love from the audience, that exchange of love that you're trying to give them something wonderful that they can take with them. The idea that you're taking a group of disparate strangers who might never talk to each other on the street and getting them to connect in a moment with an idea. When they're all laughing together, that's them all agreeing on something.
That's
even
the best.
If they don't agree on anything else in the world, you've brought that together. So that's a great bit of love to give, you know, some strangers. And in return, you know, on the good nights, they give you that sort of love back that you get. But that's not the love that you give yourself. It's a completely separate thing to that transactional nature of, you know, performance. So the loving yourself thing is much more difficult, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's only something, through years of therapy. I'm not currently in therapy, but I want to get back into it. And exploring all those ideas that I realized, you know, and I think this is common for people, but in the past, like the voice in my head, I would speak to myself in such an unkind, horrible way. Just, it was like constantly, what have you done wrong today? What are you about to do wrong? Let's ruminate on all the things you've done in the past that are horrible, but none of them would be, you know, until I kind of realized the disconnect between how I would speak to myself in my head and how I would speak to anyone else in the world. A friend, you know, I wouldn't beat someone up the same way that I did to myself.
I think, well, in a lot of people's case, and certainly in a lot of performers' cases, that I think is an internal, you know, there is a, if you are trying to pick apart the world, like if your brain works on a way where you are looking at an idea and then you are trying to look at that idea from a whole bunch of angles and pick it apart and see what's at the core of it and, you know, then see if you can put it back together in a different direction, then it's hard to switch those mechanics of how your brain works off, you know, when you're judging your day-to-day and what you're doing with your life. So how did you manage to go from, you know, that being a kind of negative self-talk, you yeah. know, in your head, to that being more of a going, I'm going to treat myself a bit more the way that I judge and treat other people?
I'm not sure. I think it was like just a question of, first of all, trying to even catch that negative voice, like recognizing that it's not objective reality. It's not objective reality that like, man, you really screwed up this morning when you, because it could go from the tiniest thing. It could go from, I don't know, you made the wrong choice for breakfast or whatever. So I think it's first of all, catching that voice, and then just as much as you can, trying to first of all negate it, neutralize it, and then when you can crank it positive, that's the best. Like that was like a revelation for me even just a few years ago that like, not only do you not have to feel bad about things, you can choose to feel good about things. How good is that?
I mean,
like
that
choices
is...
that you've made, and you know, like, gosh, I can't think of a good example. But I will say, like, and this is a little joke that I've done in the shows. I don't mean to do jokes here, but it illustrates the point of a few years ago, I was in therapy and I realized that I'm hard on myself. This is what she was like, you're really hard on yourself. And I was like, yeah, I'm really hard on myself. And I felt that. And then my immediate next thought, of course, was like, oh, I should have figured this out years ago. I'm such an idiot. And I was right. like, no, there it is. There it is. So it's like a question of catching it, you know? Does that resonate with you at all?
I love that. Yeah. That's a beautiful thought, but B, it's also a very beautiful joke. It's just a great like joke as much as it is a great observation about, you know, who we are as human beings. One of the more interesting things, I was a bit different. Like certainly the one thing the most useful thing, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, it comes up a little bit, but the most useful thing that I ever got out of therapy, because I was going at one stage, particularly because I was having a work relationship that as in like a power dynamic relationship mm-hmm. at work that was giving me a lot of trouble, and I was having a really hard time dealing with it. And eventually we got down to the nub of, yeah, with the therapist and I about what the actual problem was.
Yeah.
And the problem was that the people that I was working for, they wanted me to like them. Like that's what they really wanted.
Ah.
They wanted me to be excited to be working there and tell them how much I like them and blah, blah, blah. And that's just not how I work in mm-hmm. a general sense. Like my way of saying that I like working for you is by coming and doing a really good job and not complaining about anything. I'm just not one of those people who feels like we all then have to go around on Friday night and have a spa together and watch the football or whatever. And the other thing is that they were doing some things that made me not like them. Like I had some legitimate reasons to, you know, be uncomfortable about it. And then my therapist said to me, because my thing is like, if I'm having a problem with you, then I kind of, it's not like I'm a person who'd be like, this is the problem I'm having with you, but I'm not just going to pretend that something isn't problematic. And she said to me, she goes, but do you realize that most of the drama is coming out of the fact that you just won't pretend that you like them? She said, it would be easier for you. It will clean up all the things you're complaining about, all the things that are bothering you. If you just go in every day and lie to them about how much fun you are having, I bet all these other problems clear up. And it seems so counterintuitive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like to not be truthful in that situation. But she was 100% right. The minute that I just started going in and just starting with, I'm so, you know, grateful to be here, thanks for that, you know, just anytime they made some. And then she said, and every time you lie to them, you're not losing any power. In fact, you're gaining power because you know that you're now in control of the situation. You're just doing it in a different way.
Yeah.
And it was the greatest bit of advice I ever got in my life. Because the truth of it is, once I started being positive about them, they stopped being negative about the other stuff. And I actually did have a better relationship with them. I did feel more positive towards them.
And then
them.
Did it become self-fulfilling?
It did become, yeah.
Yeah.
It was an amazing counterintuitive, you know, sort of game changer for me, which was I could just, I mean, I guess it's fake it until you make it, you know, in regard to the nature of the relationship. But I was getting in my own way, you know.
Totally, yeah.
Anyway. So
therapy is so good like that because it's like a friend you just have to pay a little bit to be really selfish with, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing, right, when you're a comedian, I think, is finding a safe space to be able to express your thoughts and anxieties in a way that isn't comedic. Because if you're doing it on stage, like if you're using the stage as therapy, and sometimes it can be both, like it can be, but you're essentially packaging a real life experience into something that becomes an audience's story. You know, it no longer becomes your story. It becomes a story for the audience. Whereas a therapist, you don't have to, you know, you're paying them. They don't need to hear a laugh every minute or whatever in that situation. So it's a different conversation, right?
I realized I needed to either get more real in therapy. And this was years ago, or change therapists, because I found myself about six sessions in, I was doing bits.
Right.
Because she was the style who, she didn't like initiate much conversation. She just kind of wanted you to
sat
sit down
back and
yeah.
to talk.
And then at the some guts. Point I was like, ooh, just started like, and it was about like, you know what I mean? About switching into that mode. Yeah. It was about like my real anxieties, but I did it in a way that I had done it on stage before and kind of gave it to her that way. And I think it was a bit of a test that she did not pass because she didn't pick up on it.
Right.
And she was just sitting there laughing, like having a great time. Right. And I was like, wait a minute. And then I left. Like, why did I pay her for me to just do bits at her for the last 20 minutes?
What is it about talking about, you know, these things that is powerful? Because, like, I've heard as many people talk about going to therapy and it causing more problems than, you know what I mean? Like, there's maybe some things you don't need to talk about.
You can overthink things, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's maybe you just go, actually, I didn't need to talk to a stranger about this for an hour. I probably could have just forgotten about it. You know, I kind of probably could have just moved on from it or pushed it aside. Is there a value in, what value do you find in talking about things that are, you know, whether it be your anxieties or other things that you're talking about in those situations? What is the value that you are getting out of it?
To me, the value is like kind of knowing that I'm not necessarily going to work on this stuff on my own without a reason. So, and like I said, I'm not going at the moment, but when I do go, it's like, I never want to go. I'm always like, I'm fine, you know, but so it's this reluctance to go, but that's like this weekly commitment that I have to keep with myself and with the other person to see what's going on in my life. So to me, it's like paying a smart friend to pay attention. To me, the best moments are when they can come back at you and go, you realize like you've been talking about this for a while, or I'm connecting this to something you said about your dad seven sessions ago. And you're like, oh, yeah. Like I just that bit of guidance, I think, is incredible. I really think everybody could benefit from it. But as you say, I see the point. There's also like there's a point at which you can be ruminating about tiny things that you can just let go.
So when you're putting together a show, because this show you're doing in Melbourne as part of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
Oh, yes.
Is a bit different to where you are ordinarily in your schedule, is my impression. You normally maybe bring out something that's, you know, you've done a little bit more than the show that you've brought out this year. Is that
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So this one is really interesting because I tried for whatever reason, because I'm just like this, I guess. I had a great great season last year. I loved my show. It was so much fun. I called it Post-Joke Era, which felt like, you know, a good timing for a title. And it kind of, there's so much that could go in there. And then this year, as you know, we write the blurbs for this festival in like about October. They're all due. The title, the image, the description of the show. And I was like, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to commit to a theme. Because I never know what I'm doing by October, but I thought I could commit to a theme. So I was like, I'm going to talk about money. That's something that's a taboo that's in everyone's life. I mean, it's not a bad idea, but I just did not do it. And then I called this show Worth It. I bought all these books about like the economy because I wanted to learn about the economy right. and capitalism. I really have a stack of books at home. And I did this photo shoot, a green background. I'm wearing a bow tie made of American money that I made myself. Like I was committed to the theme. And then flash forward, it's like January. I'm like, oh God, like I had maybe 15 minutes of kind of okay, kind of money related material. And Will's laughing over there, rubbing his eyes. And I just couldn't do it. So the way that I work is like, I have to talk about whatever's fascinating me at the moment and what's obsessing me at the moment. And I can't, I've never tried to commit to a theme because it's just not how I work. And this year that I tried, I completely failed. So the show is, I'll come out for like 30 seconds and do a quick like, hey, if you're here because the blurb drew you in, just understand I did not write that show. You know, I sneak a couple of jokes in there and just let everybody know that's not what we're going to see. I don't think anybody cares.
I was about to say, I'm not sure that people are coming along going, Finally.
Yeah.
Finally that show.
Let's talk about this
finally
show.
Finally that comedy show that's going to take down capitalism.
Right?
That's the one.
I know. It's embarrassing on every level.
It's not though, because that's the nature of, like, I mean, people ask me all the time about the Will puns in the name. And I said, I'd love to tell you some great story, but it's all practicality. Like, I can't call my show, you know, 22 Things I Learned from My Dad, because you're asking me what it's called in August, you know, so I can put Adelaide Fringe Rego in, and I'm in the middle of the previous tour. I haven't started thinking about the next tour. Just give it a name that promises that it's a new show. That's right. All that the name needs to do. I might as well just call it, yep, it's a new show. Come and see the new
it's
show.
It's a new show, part 19.
Right. I don't think that people, I mean, I think it's pretty rare that people are coming along hoping that the grand question in the title will be answered.
I finally figured that out. I mean, I've never worked that way. And then somehow this year I'm like, I'm going to do it. Because I think I appreciate when people do it. I admire that. Yeah. And now I thank you for saying that, because now I feel even more secure. Like, I never need to try to do that again.
Tell me this. What is it that fascinates you? Like, you know, when you said you want to write about things that are engaging you, things that you are fascinated by, that's how you work. That's where your material comes from.
Yeah.
So then how do you kind of decide what it is you're... I know this sounds like a weird question. How do you decide what you're fascinated by? But there is some decision-making process, because you could as easily be fascinated by the Real Housewives of California as be fascinated by capitalism or feminism or whatever the many various, you know, things in between. So how, when you're saying what is it that I'm fascinated by, what is it that I want to talk about, how are you actually making that decision in your head?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I don't know that I'm deciding it as much, but as you said, there's so much going on. I definitely steer away from politics in like on a small scale, because there's so much going on right now that I feel like it's best left to everybody else. Like, it's best left to the nightly shows with their team of writers, and everything is changing so quickly.
And Twitter.
I mean,
the idea of doing topical political material is just like, I mean, because even if you came up with a great joke, chances are by the time that you do it the third night of your show, 1,800 people have done it on Twitter worldwide.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's
so what does that mean then? Because I actually have found that as well. Like, yeah. I mean, I used to joke about some things that would be those sort of things, and don't at all anymore for the exact same reason.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that lack of opportunity there open up as a different opportunity in the way that you approach? Because you're still a person, I think, who wants to not talk about those small issues, but you want to talk about the larger, perhaps, themes and issues that those things are about.
That's
right?
Exactly it. But let me also just say, I always think of you as someone who, I really admire the way you approach political topics, and you seem to do it so quickly. Like, I definitely remember being like side stage during some of the galas, and you're just out there with these amazing, like really current jokes. I'm like, how does this guy do this?
Lack of other skills. I've managed to luck myself into a career, and I am desperately holding on to it for as long as it will happen, because I know that every year I get closer and closer to it being over. I feel like I've had a good run, and I can just feel the wobble on the, you know, on the roller coaster at the top where you go, oh, hang on, the big drop happens any minute now. Let's just see if we can bring out a couple more moments of enjoyment out of what has been a blessed and lucky career. So what do you do then? How do you look at that bigger picture?
This is, maybe I have to take it sideways a little bit, but something happening in Toronto at the moment, which is where I live most of the year, and I'm sure it's happening everywhere, where these rooms are cropping up, and it's a wonderful development in comedy, but these rooms are explicitly like feminist, queer, anti-oppressive, safe spaces, you know, a place where anybody who's felt unwelcome in a traditional comedy club can go and know that you can just relax, you're not going to be the butt of a joke, you know. And I think it's great. I think it's great that the scene is developing. And at the same time, it made me realize that I don't like doing comedy where there's no tension.
Right.
Because I'd been doing like a certain brand of feminist comedy in unsafe spaces and comedy clubs and whatnot. And I think I kind of got used to or started to thrive on that that tension and the back and forth and the, I'll throw you guys a little sexist bone so that I can make this larger point about something else. And I'll talk about how I perv on girls so that maybe you can hear me when I say maybe none of us should, you know, or we had to be more careful in the way that we do it. So then I found myself doing these like feminist rooms, and they just felt like a rally. Right. Like everyone's like, yeah, we agree. And I'm like, oh man. And yeah, I didn't really realize that that was part of my comedic personality or my personality, that I don't find it so interesting when everybody already agrees.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because when we talk about political stuff,
yeah,
I often find if I will play a night that is a political night and do my political material, I get that, you know, a round of agreements, mm-hmm, on everybody. Yes, hear, hear. Yes, we believe in marriage equality as well,
here,
sir.
Here.
And,
yeah,
you know, the Republic and, well, all these, you know, hot button issues. But also what I will tend to find is that my material probably isn't quite as strong as they are, because my material has been built to take those sort of ideas to a big, broad, yes, audience of people who don't necessarily, like, my piece about, you know, why we should change the date of Australia Day. In the political room, you can just go straight to the, you know, dispossession of our, you know, Indigenous people, and they understand why we should change it. But my routine goes for 10 minutes and I run through a whole bunch of other things to sell it to an audience who don't give a shit about the Indigenous people. You know, I try to get... So there is the tension of, like, taking those ideas to a space that isn't just filled with people who agree with the ideas that you already have. So talk to me about that, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you nailed it. That's exactly it, that you want to communicate to a larger group of people than the people that already agree. And I found the same thing. I found that more so in the past, people think that I do political, like, you know, political style humor or something, and they'll put me on these gigs. I'm like, this isn't really what I'm doing. But I think just by, in general, kind of, you know, definitely being a feminist, being queer. Last year I was talking about being agender on stage. Just by virtue of being who I am, in some places that's going to look political. And in other places it's going to look like, yep, you're just like all of us. What else? What else?
Yeah, we're all that too.
Yeah.
That's why we came.
Yeah.
What else have you got?
Yeah, I had this one, like this little beginning of the joke about the agender stuff, where I go, you know, regardless of how you perceive me, I don't feel like a woman. Ugh, I don't want to be a man. Gross. No offense, everyone. And then I do like a big sweeping gesture over the audience. That works when there are men and women in the audience.
Right.
When it's 70% queer and everybody has the same haircut as me, they're like, yeah, what?
Why are you even saying this?
Yeah, exactly.
That was assumed.
So that's...
Well, that's interesting, that's though, because I think that gender seems to be... Because obviously Australia... And this, you know, I mean, I don't think that I'm wrong on this, but if I am, please feel free to tell me that I am. But obviously...
We'll let the internet handle that.
My experience of, you know, having performed, you know, a little bit in Canada, and, you know, obviously visited there a lot, and then obviously, you know, performed the majority of my career here, is that, you know, put it this way. I still had some good chunks on, you know, how we should have marriage equality that I couldn't do in Canada for about a decade, while I could still do them in Australia. You
right.
know, we were lagging behind in regard to those sort of things. Gender seems to be certainly, if you were looking at something now in Australia that the, you know, the sort of marriage equality opponents have moved on to, it seems to be about and around definitions and uncomfortable, you know, being uncomfortable with people defining gender as sort of non-binary, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like not being, is that, do you feel like that is, and what is the difference between how that's perceived in Canada and how it's perceived in Australia?
Oh, you know, I don't know necessarily everything that's going on with legislation, but I think that Canada definitely has some things in place where it's not too difficult. I could be wrong, but I think it's better than some countries where if you say, you know, if you're transitioning or you say the gender that I am doesn't match the gender on all of my, on my birth certificate, on my driver's license, whatever, you can just go through a procedure and take care of it. I think it's, you can definitely run into some jerks in that bureaucratic process, but for the most part, I think it's kind of straightforward and people understand that that happens and that's just a part of life. You know, it's not, I don't think there's a lot of, fuss or worry about, but then what are we going to do with these people? It's like, well, you just do this and, you know, then it's fine. I was on radio the other day and somewhat shocked. I don't even know how it came up. It was me and another comedian. We were meant to just talk about comedy. This is at the ABC. And somehow the guy, he really felt like he crowbarred in this marriage equality thing into the conversation, which was so strange. He was like, have you noticed a lot of changes in Melbourne? Like, we have marriage equality now and this and that. And somehow he, this radio host, got on to the point like, well, you know, but 40% of people voted against it and they have their reasons. And I'm like, what is happening in this interview? What are we even talking about right now? Yeah. Thank you for your perplexed face. It was so strange and felt like such a like 180 of the conversation, and made me realize that perhaps things are more tense here than I realize, or maybe there's, I don't know how this guy felt about it, or if he was trying to protect listeners that he believed were.
Probably it's this, you know, unfortunately what has happened in this country is that the national broadcaster, the ABC in particular, has been forced into this idea of presenting what I would say is false balance.
Mm.
In the same way as if they have somebody on talking about the dangers of climate change, they feel compelled to have some, you know, wingnut on who says that it's not happening.
Right. Yeah, I guess that is sometimes how a lot of media approaches things. It's like, this other side.
Right. We have to show the other side. Even if the other side are completely wrong, or if the fact that he said 40% of people voted no, that actually didn't happen. Some people just didn't vote.
That's what I brought up. Thank you. I was like, I assume there's more people that are in favor. I was like, that's 40% of who voted. There's going to be more people in favor of yes that didn't vote.
Absolutely. Because the ones who were really against it voted no.
Of course.
Right. And most people assumed it was going to get through. So there'd be some young people and stuff, and there was evidence of this, who were just like, well, I don't need to vote.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to happen, you know, and luckily it did, or that would have been trouble. But the other thing is, the around the world, the experience has been every single place after they've brought in marriage equality, that even if it was 60-40 when the vote happened, it'll be 70-30 by 2 years later, and then it'll be 80-20 because many of the people who were conned into thinking that suddenly once, you know, gay people could get married, you know, the fucking sky'd fall in and, you know, all the children would be taught how to be gimps at you know, primary school or whatever, you know, fear campaign, you know, was run. They suddenly realize, I don't think my kids had a gimp class at all. I feel like I was lied to. All those gay people seem real happy. So
why do I love this image of the five-year-old gimp? Oh, that's so funny.
I'm just interested in that in a perspective of material in some ways is, I guess, the question I'm asking you, though, because when you're coming from somewhere, you know, that is, you know, has been more progressive than Australia has been,
mm-hmm.
does it mean that you have to change the perspective of, you know, something that you're talking about because the audience are at a different stage of the evolution of, you know, where they are on those topics, or has it never been a problem in that sense?
I don't have to change too much between Canada and Australia. Although a couple years ago, I was making fun of Australia with a joke, one of my earliest jokes in Canada that I don't even really do anymore. But I joked about being gay divorced because I got, well, you know, quote, gay married. And then a year later, I got gay divorced. So I had fun before you guys had marriage equality by being like, you guys are so far behind. Yeah. Like, there's so much more going on right now. Gay divorce is happening. Yeah. Like, yeah. So I haven't found that I'd have to change too much between Canada and Australia.
What has been the appeal? I mean, you're a traveler. Why is that for a start? Like, what was it that, you know, because there's often, you know, comedians who stay where they are,
yeah.
you know, and build their career around where it is that they are based and they live. And then there seems to be another sort of bunch of, you know, traveling vagabonds who, you know, pack up their suitcase every now and again. And I don't just mean to travel around and, you know, play shows, do the road, but I mean, you know, coming to Australia to do a couple of festivals and some, you know, shows and stuff like that, that's a huge chunk of
it's a big track.
Your year, you know, and you've done it now. How many times have you been to Melbourne for the festival?
I mean, in Melbourne, I'm not even sure, at least 6 times over the year, and I missed a few years here and there.
Like 10 or 11 years, right?
Like, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's been a decade at least of you kind of coming out doing shows. So that's
sure.
a lot of commitment to be coming back here and, you know, traveling around the world. What part of that is, you know, satisfying to you? What do you get out of the sort of traveling to do your work?
Yeah. Well, I'll take it back and just tell you that I started coming to Australia because of a girl, of course, the reasons I do anything ever. And so because she was Australian and it made perfect sense in our lives then. It was right. like, this is incredible. You live in Canada and then we go visit your family, spend some months in your country, you know, and then we broke up and I just kept coming because I had enough momentum here and enjoyed it. Now I come here. And I've thought about it a lot, but when I'm here, it feels weirdly like home. You know, there is this group of people that I've known for over 10 years, and it's just, the festival time is amazing. You know, you just go out. It's like everyone you know and love is in the Melbourne CBD, and it's just easy to run into people, have a drink, talk about comedy. I love the whole vibe, and I love the whole Australian scene now, and I have enough friends that I come back.
Do you find it amazing? Not amazing. Amazing is probably the wrong word, the wrong way to put it, but... I spent kind of 8 years over the last decade, you know, doing a lot of touring in America, you know, sort of going on the road, like playing clubs, doing the proper, you know, like road experience. And just over the nature of like, you know, if you end up coming back to some places enough, you know, if I'm in Cleveland every year, if I'm in Denver every year, if I'm in, you know, some places, suddenly after 5 or 6 years, you're suddenly like, oh, hang on, I have an audience here.
Right.
Like, there's a whole bunch of people in Denver who are fans of mine.
Yeah,
and
so
come
great.
Out to my shows, yeah. Right? Which is weird, you know, because you're just like, I get it here. I'm from here. This is where I started.
Yeah.
You know, if people didn't come and see me here, I'd be disappointed. But you, in a whole other country, have a whole bunch of people who are fans of yours who've probably been watching you over the years and, are, you know, you're the first person they go and see when you decide to come out. And that must be quite a... like delightful thing to know that even when you're just at home, you know, back at home, you're like, well, you know what? There's a little Australian audience sitting down under waiting for me to come back.
That's so cute. I've never really thought about it that way. But it's true. I would say that, like, I feel like Australian audiences probably know me better as a comic than anywhere else because they have like seen this development. And Australia's very lucky. You know this more from having traveled around, but I think you really have dedicated comedy fans here. And in general, Australians are really what I would call comedy savvy, comedy literate. I feel like you have your own strong scene that's developing and your own legacy and Australian comics that have been around for years. And then you get the kind of American influence and you get the UK influence. I find that Australians can talk about comedy and appreciate comedy in a way that's slightly more nuanced maybe than general Canadian crowds, for sure.
We definitely get that. I mean, that observation you've just had there is, I think, is such a good one, which is because our style was almost equally influenced by the British and the Americans, you know, it's actually added, you know, there's a very, you know, strong storytelling tradition here, but it's kind of punctuated with jokes in the way that, you know, the American influence is, you know. And we don't have that thing that the Canadians have of being next to America and everything that comes with being next to America.
Yeah.
And we're far enough away from Britain to understand that. But it's also meant that British comedians can come here and do very well and American comedians can come here and do very well and Canadian comedians because we're not used to just a style of comedy as an audience. You know, you can bring something here and people will go, okay, yeah, all right. That, you know, we're prepared for this as well.
Yeah, so, I love that. That, like, and I started coming here early on in my comedy development, like maybe year two or something. So I feel like in many ways I've been influenced by Australia. I think people are starting to know Australian comics more all over the world and Netflix is helping, obviously. More and more are getting invited to Just for Laughs, all these places. But I remember early on feeling like, oh, like I had this amazing secret and I would go back and tell my little open mic pals and everybody else like, you should see what Will Anderson is doing. There's this guy, Sam Simmons, you know, like there was just no correlation in North America for what was going on here. And it was exciting to feel like.
You will have seen this festival. I mean, I've been doing it for 22 years now.
But, which is, it blows my mind.
But
yeah,
to see the last decade for me, how much it's changed and that next level of, you know, generation of comedians who have now come through. Like I was saying to somebody backstage at my show last night that I've only seen 5 shows this festival and all 5 of them would any other year at the festival be the best show that I would have seen at the festival.
Wow.
And there's another probably 10 or 15 that people tell me are equally as good.
Yeah.
You know, you have this range of people like, you know, Ann Edmonds and Becky Lucas and Nath Valvo and, you know, all these wonderful people, you know, Laura Davis, who I just think is amazing.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, but like the fact that Laura Davis isn't a household name, the fact that Laura Davis isn't somebody, I mean, who, and I'm determined.
Yeah.
This is my new thing. It's like, I'm determined to mention Laura Davis's name at any stage
I'm loving
I possibly
this.
Can.
Because, I do it in Canada. Let's talk more about Laura Davis.
Like, I mean, I'm an amazing comedian. I haven't seen this year's show, but I've heard it's, I saw last year's and it was probably my favorite show I saw in the entire festival, and I've heard this year's is equally as good. And this is what this festival is now.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and see somebody and see these people making these, you know, amazing pieces of work. It's kind of crazy to me, particularly in the last decade, how much that next generation has flourished.
Yeah, it's incredible. And Laura, I'd love to talk about Laura for a minute. So I've been a fan of hers forever. But it was 2015's Ghost Machine, which she's doing again this year.
Yeah, that's the one she's doing again.
I think that was the one that really blew my mind. And I felt like she just became... I feel like she really embraced her strengths or things. You know, she's a very like sweet and soft-spoken kind of person. And I think that could have been like a detriment to her in blustery, bam, 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 bam style of comedy, what we're used to. But I don't know what she did, but she just took control of it. And Ghost Machine is just a lovely show. And she hits all these topics, suicide, you know, existential angst in this really smart way that... I would go back to Canada and I would tell people, I saw the show in his basement, Laura Davis, you don't know her. She's this, you know, 26-year-old Australian. I'm like, she's doing stuff that is like surpassing the level. And this is a few years ago before the quote scandal, you know, surpassing kind of Louis C.K. level of comedy in what she's achieving.
She does also actually force a lot of other comedians to watch her masturbate, which is the only the only downside that I can find about her.
I mean, I enjoy it, so I've never complained.
Yeah, that's true equality.
Oh, what a horrible image. She's such a sweet girl.
I know. I can say it because I feel pretty safe that those words are never going to come back to haunt me.
It's just that so mentioning the name Louis C.K. is so dirty now that I felt I didn't want to compare them. But
okay, well, okay, let me talk about that.
Yeah, because, let's talk about that.
And look, you know, this is certainly not a, you know, an interview where, like, hopefully it's ever going to be one of those
hard
lines.
What's
it like to be a woman in, you know, comedy or anything like that. But obviously, there is so much debate around the behavior of people in comedy now. And a lot of it has to do with the changing of the times, you know, in that idea that, you know, this is now, as in the broader world, you know, women within comedy, not just women, like, but the unrepresented minorities, but aren't minorities, of course, but have been seen as minorities within the industry or have been made to feel like minorities within the industry. You know, we've got a lineup, we've got a woman on, you know, or we've got a lineup, we've got an Asian guy on. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the idea that you're the token representative of who you are, that feels like those walls have kind of crashed down in a pretty major way now.
Yeah,
or at least
they're
in the process of being smashed down, and people are dealing with the various consequences of that on various levels. How do you feel about where comedy is in that sort of broader sense of, you know, what sort of space it's becoming for different performers and how it is changing? Do you understand the question?
Yeah,
that I'm asking?
I think
I'm
so.
I'm asking it in a very clumsy way because it's a delicate, you know, enough topic, but I'd love to hear your thoughts
around it. Yeah, I'm really excited about, like, in general, I just see more underrepresented voices becoming more prominent. And I think in general in society and in comedy, we'll just focus on comedy for a second, there is this kind of backlash. So we kind of are at this moment where a lot of people are like, okay, we've heard enough from straight white men for a minute. We want to hear different points of view. We want to hear what's going on with Black women. We want to hear from the indigenous point of view. You know, I would say that even I'm kind of taking a step back. Cause I'm like, whatever. I'm queer. Who cares? Like, we've heard this enough. I think
you're queer. You're here. Yeah. We're used to it.
Yeah. We're used to it. Exactly. I'm here. I'm queer. We're all over it.
Yeah, we're all over it.
I just love that all these underrepresented voices feel like they're getting a chance to shine. I don't think this is just a moment. I think it's a real change and it's only going to continue moving forward from here.
It doesn't feel like there's a way of, and by the way, not that I'm suggesting this should be the thing, but there feels like there's no genie back in the bottle moment here.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it feels to me, and you can feel it across society, and sometimes you... we were in the US talking to some people about Gruen, and there was a whole bunch of people who were really interested in doing the show over there. And And the major thing it kept coming back to was like, they were saying, you know, you're a white guy in your mid-40s. This is, for the first time ever in entertainment history,
yeah,
this is not a great time, you know, to be you. And I was like, in my head, like, you know, your initial thing would be like,
yeah.
But in the grand scheme of things, you're like, I've had a right run. I've had plenty of opportunities, and no one's saying that I have to stop doing show business. They're just saying that right now they're not going to put this show on TV. You know, like, it's good. It's a good thing. Like, you know, to be able to have gone from watching Kumail on stage at Meltdown when I first moved to, you know, America, to see him being a leading man in fucking Hollywood and, you know, writing with Emily, an Oscar nominated movie, and then suddenly being, you know, hosting Saturday Night Live and these sort of things. You're suddenly like, this is great.
Yeah.
Like, I love this. This is, and the more broad the performers are, the more broad the audience is, you know?
Yeah.
Because the great thing about Kumail is, or about, you know, whoever these people are that are coming in, you know, they bring with them a whole bunch of people who felt like they were neglected by comedy before.
That's it. That's what's really blowing my mind is, like, in Toronto, there's this, the show called Shade, run by this woman, Anne Simone. And she just routinely sells out the show, had a year anniversary in this huge theater, sold it out. And it's, for the most part, this audience that I haven't yet seen in comedy clubs. They're, you know, they're young, they're queer, they're multicultural. It's just awesome to perform for them. And it's awesome to sit in the audience and hear what the other comics are doing. And, you know, just going like, okay, yeah, that's not my experience. I don't know what it's like to have, you know, Ethiopian immigrant parents, but it looks like, you know, 40% of this audience totally gets that reference. Right. I mean, I find that sort of thing really fun and, you know, mind expanding.
Yeah, I love nothing more than, it's like I went and saw Des Bishop. Do you know Des?
Yeah, of course. So
one night when he first came out to Australia, because Des was, you know, obviously a big Irish name at the time. Yeah, he's mm-hmm. Irish American, but he had very popular Irish career. And so it was like the peak of this. And I saw him at the Gaelic Club, which is an Irish club in Sydney. And because the audience was, like, I would have said I was probably the only non-Irish person in the entire room. He was like doing bits in Gaelic and he was doing all these things. And I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, there was bits of it I didn't get. Like, there was bits of it that just went over my head. But the watching somebody say something to a room full of people that they all got.
Yeah.
There's nothing alienating about that.
It's
wonderful.
Yeah, it's so funny that you mentioned Des, because just last night I was backstage with him right before his show, and we were watching the comedian Angelo Zaroukas, who comes from Canada, and he's performing at the Greek Center. Yeah. His audience, I mean, must have been mostly Greek, and it was his closing bit. The audience was losing their minds. It was very clear that they just loved an hour of the show. And then the closing bit seemed to be kind of translating Greek songs into English, or maybe pointing out how over the top and dramatic they are. So he'd sing a bit of the song in Greek, and people would lose their minds just at that. And Des and I are just watching these waves of, you know, recognition and laughter roll over the audience, and we're understanding none of it. Like, he'd do the lyric, and then he'd go, "Because in English they're saying this," and everyone would be like, "Yeah, that's so ridiculous." And it was like, wow. But you still can't help but get caught up in it. Like, it feels amazing.
So where are you in your comedy career? Like, where does it, as in, like, how do you feel about, you know, where you're at? Like, what is it that you're liking about what it is that you do? You know, what is it that you want to be moving towards, you know, that sort of vibe?
Those are good questions. I still feel like a baby in comedy. I mean, I have to recognize that I'm not, you know, that
there. How long have you been doing it now?
12 years.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
That's still babyish,
though. I still feel like a baby in comedy, but I, you know, I recognize there's all new generations coming up.
You've heard that theory, though, before, that your kind of age is the amount of years you've been doing it, right?
That seems about right. Yeah.
So, you know, 12 is still, you're still adolescent comedy. Yeah. You haven't moved into your moody, you know, kind of teenage years of comedy.
Oh, no, yet. I'm going to get moody. Yeah, and, you know, I may always feel like that, because for me, I didn't get into comedy necessarily with an end goal or with the idea of a career. So it was funny to me when people would say, you know, what do you hope to achieve in comedy? And I'm like, No. I'm not playing that game. That's why I got into comedy. Right. You know, I'm not doing the work and the achievement and the outside success and what is the story of your life. Like, that's why I'm doing comedy. But since comedy has like experienced a boom in the past, what, maybe 5 years? Things have changed even in the 12 years that I've been doing it, where it does seem like a valid career path, and you know, a way through which you can really achieve. I'm just happy to do, I really just want to do stand-up. I'm happy to do stand-up forever. I love it. I'm working on a pilot at home in Canada, and I'm happy about that too. And I hope that it goes forward and becomes a series. That would be incredible. But the funny thing about that is, and I don't want to talk the universe out of giving me this, but I didn't ask for it. I went out to lunch with this production company, this lovely woman, and she was like, so how do you feel about acting? And I didn't realize what was at stake. You know, I'm just in it to be in it. And I was like, ugh, I think acting is like embarrassing. You know, I'm like, sometimes I'm watching movies and I'm like, how are you two grown men arguing about a spaceship? Aren't you embarrassed for yourselves? Like, how? And so that was like lunch number one. And then we just walked away. Lunch number two was like, okay, but how might you feel about acting if maybe you were playing yourself? And I was like, maybe, I don't know, you know, and then I leave. And then lunch number three is like, so, you know, I was realizing it's maybe not fair of me to just expect you to come up with this whole thing on your own. What I'm saying is, yes, I want to create something with you.
Hey, dummy.
Yeah.
And I tried to like, ease you into this idea. Hey, dummy, what I'm trying to
and
say.
And I was
is,
like, oh, yeah. You know, so I feel maybe at odds with what a lot of comedians want to do. You know, so many people get into comedy because they want to have a sitcom or they, I'm just very happy to do stand up and see where it goes.
There's two things I want to talk about there. Cause I feel like I was lucky here that I started at a point where just before I grew up in the era, almost the perfect timing.
Yeah.
I grew up in the era where this became a job.
Right.
In Australia. But when I started it, it wasn't a job. Right. Yeah. So I got the luxury of going, I chose this not because I thought I'd get a career out of it. I chose it because I wanted to do it regardless of what that meant. Like you said, you know, I didn't choose this going, I'll do this and this and this. I chose it because I was like, I'd like to get on stage in front of people and tell jokes.
Yeah.
And then around that, an industry grew that meant that I could also do it as my job and my career.
Mm-hmm.
I think now people... you would be naive to get into it thinking that it's only about telling jokes. I mean, there is an industry now that regardless of whether you want to involve yourself in it or not, it will be there around you and people will ask you about, you know, those sort of things. The question that I always get asked by people who don't do stand-up is why I still do stand-up. You know, like people can't understand that.
That hurt my heart. That question hurt my heart. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Why when you have a TV show or why when you have something else, why you're still doing stand-up. They can't get their mind around it.
Yeah.
What, rather than me, you know, talking about this because, you know, it's not much of a podcast if I just talk. Why do you love stand-up? What is it about stand-up? You know, the number one thing, the priority being stand-up. What puts it above everything else?
I'll stumble through this. I'll do my best to articulate, but I think we would both agree that there's something... so magical and special about that live experience. Like you said earlier, it's a group of disparate people that have come together in that moment to share ideas and share laughter, which is transformative. It's an amazing thing. Personally, for me, what I've discovered, and this is a somewhat selfish way of looking at it, is I find that through stand-up, I am like my best self. I become a better version of myself because it's only stand-up that has made me confront issues that I need to confront in my real life. And I absolutely have to confront them in order to be better at stand-up. And a small example of that would be really early on, kind of what we were talking about earlier, but really early on, I had a horrible gig, it's fun to think about now because it was a quintessential horrible gig. I'd been doing comedy maybe 2 months in Montreal, and then I was asked to do my first paid gig, and it was through the Comedy Nest, and it was in this little town outside of Montreal called Chateauguay, which I'd never been to. It felt like going back in time. They weren't the, you know, hip urban Montreal crowd that I was used to, and I'd been barely doing stand-up. I was asked to do 10 minutes. I did not really have 10 minutes. But I went up there, performed to complete silence, like no heckling, thank God, but just complete silence. After the gig, this woman came up to me and said, and it was sweet, but it's not what you want to hear. She goes, "Oh, honey, we felt so bad for you up there."
I mean, I love that so much because I think she's trying to be sweet.
No, she absolutely was, but I thought that's
the most heartbreaking and horrible thing that you could possibly say.
I'm like, that's the opposite of the feeling I meant to give you. You're not supposed to sit there for 10 minutes just enduring and feeling pity and sadness
for
me.
I guess if you want to look at it in a glass half full sort of way, like your intention was to, you know, get a whole bunch of disparate people to combine together with an emotion.
Oh, and they felt it. They felt it.
It feels like they all felt the same thing. It's just...
I mean, and it just piles on. The worst thing too was I'd gotten a ride there with some other comics. I didn't know how to get back to Montreal on my own, so they had great sets. And so, and it's a Friday night. They're sitting around drinking. I'm just like hanging out, knowing that like nobody liked that. I don't even like myself right now. What is happening? And then at the same time, it was my first paid gig. So I did 10 minutes. The club owner was like, "All right," gave me $100. And that felt like so much. And it was like, what is this life? Like, this is incredible. And I went home and kind of thought, it was the first time I realized, and I feel like I was late to the game with this, but at least I figured it out. It was the first time that I realized I could stay at home now and beat myself up and feel bad and tell myself, you know, how horrible that was and I shouldn't be doing this, whatever. Or I could be a friend to myself, which was really the first time it ever even occurred to me to be a friend to myself. I could be a friend to myself, just look at things objectively and say, this is what you want to do. You tried. Why did this not go well? And what can you do better next time? Just take all the emotion and anxiety out of it and just move forward. And it's like only through comedy have I found opportunities to do that with myself. So it just, to me, it just feels like my soul's path. It's the thing that I am called to do. It's the thing that I'm called to do.
I love that. I mean, you're talking to the right person.
Yeah. So, okay, good. Yeah. You see me rolling my eyes being like, oh God, am I saying this?
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about the acting, that you said, I don't want to, you know, sort of talk the universe out of, you know, giving you this thing. Is that something that you actually believe in? Is there, like, do you have a sort of sense that there is some sort of, you know, universal, you know, karmic energy or something that is connected in that way? Like, is that something that is part of your sort of day-to-day belief system, or is that just a thing that you were saying?
I mean, I kind of say it. I think that... there's something very true about the energy that we put out in the world. And I think there's a lot of stuff we don't understand yet. Maybe probably particle physicists understand it. I think there's a scientific basis for all of these ideas. I'm not smart enough to know what they are. I've just kind of vaguely heard about, you know, particles responding to other particles, even though they're separated by a vast distance. So I think we are creating our reality with, you know, the way that we speak and the way that we think about things and the energy that we put into the world.
Do you have a higher belief system of some kind? Is there like something that informs you like in a, you know, bigger belief way?
It doesn't have
to be like, you know, traditional capital G God or anything like that. But like, is there something, or it could be that, I don't, you know, it can be any of those things.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about love, and I think for me, it comes down to a feeling that I have. I mean, I think maybe we all don't have this. Sociopaths wouldn't have it. But you kind of know when you're doing, quote, the right thing, and you know when you're not.
I know. What is that?
I don't know. It's a feeling that you get.
So weird though, isn't it? It's like, nobody knows that I even did this thing. Like, you know what I mean?
Like, but I know
why
it.
Am I having all these feelings about this thing that nobody else is even aware of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had to discover through trial and error that I can't cheat on people. I tried that. I thought, if they don't know, you know, whatever. And then I would just eat myself alive with guilt. And it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter. But, and of course, I'm sure there's people listening going, there's other relationship models. You don't have to be monogamous. You can be poly. You can never take cheating out of the equation. But there was definitely a time where like I had a monogamous girlfriend and then I cheated on her. No one needs to know. And I can't do it. There's something, I don't know what it is.
When you're in a situation like that, and I'm not prying for personal details, by the way, but just in a hypothetical model. Yeah, we can take it hypothetically.
Sure.
If we need to.
It's so in the past that it doesn't even matter. Yeah.
Are you the sort of person in a situation like that where you're like, well, I feel guilty about the thing that I have done, you know, or whatever feelings you were having about the thing that you were doing. I now have to tell the other person about this transgression? Or are you the sort of person who's like, no, I have to deal with the consequences of it myself and keep it to myself? And, you know.
Yeah. In that moment, I would have said I have to deal with the consequences myself, because I don't think there's much. If you're just doing it to alleviate your guilt or something, yeah, there's not too much value in that.
You're just hurting the other person again, right?
Yeah.
For that reason.
But I will say that I'm sure in that situation, it was my own kind of guilt. That relationship dissolved anyway and would have been probably a lot stronger had I been able to address that more honestly in the moment.
It's interesting that, like, I mean, the idea of talking to somebody, I was speaking on this podcast, and people will have heard it by the time, well, they might not have heard it. They might have just downloaded this one as the first one they've ever listened to.
I mean, that happens.
If so, I did a wonderful podcast the other day with Denise Scott.
Oh, I love her, yeah.
She's honestly one of the greatest of all time. She's 63 years old. She's still doing the best work that she's, you know, done in her life and her career. I find her an incredible inspiration. She's also been married for 37 years, and she told me an amazing story about, you know, the affairs that her and her partner had like 20 years ago, but how last year they spent a year in therapy finally sort of working through something that they'd essentially just put aside for 20 years
while they were
raising kids and doing other things. And then when all the kids and other things had gone away, they realized they needed to, you know, so 37 years in, like spending a year talking about, you know, this sort of thing. You know?
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful conversation, but it was mind blowing to me, because the idea of signing yourself up for there'd be a part of me that's just like, it was 22 years ago. Let's just live on in whatever sense of denial or walls we've built up. You know, clearly we've got through 20 years, but she seemed to have got great power out of, you know, and their relationship seems to have, you know, be a better relationship now that they've gone through that than what it was before they had, which was just very interesting to me. More than anything.
That's so incredible. I mean, I sometimes just find it's hard to believe. I kind of marvel that any two people can have a relationship at all.
Right.
Like an intimate relationship, because we're all just so full of our own baggage, and we all are seeing things through our own perspectives, and it goes so deep. It goes, you know, way back to your childhood and stuff you learned before you were even conscious of learning it. Stuff you learned that you just thought, this is how the world is, you know, the same, whatever it was, like, okay, they're telling me the sky is blue. I'm looking at my parents and I'm seeing that drama is a huge part of a relationship. Like, whatever it is, you learn all these things when you're little, and that.
Well, I mean, I do a little bit at the start of my show, and it might seem to the audience like a really kind of inconsequential joke. It's about the fact that when I first moved to the city, the thing that I was most kind of like weirded out by was pet dogs. Because when you grow up on a farm, you have dogs, but you don't have pet dogs. And people treat pet dogs in a very different way to... And like the routine itself really is just along the premise of working dogs versus pet dogs.
Please tell me that Paw and Order is still in there.
Paw and Order is still in there.
Yes. And, I heard you working on that the other night. I loved it. I loved the whole thing. But
the whole point of it is that it's meant to be about that idea of going... Because the rest of the show becomes a little bit more of an exploration of that idea of the perspectives that you have that you don't even know are not the perspective that everybody else has.
Yeah.
Like, I was genuinely raised just in my life, like, that's how dogs are treated. That is how dogs are. And the minute you suddenly are in a world where people are like, oh, no, there's a whole other way that you can relate with dogs. It's meant to be as much a story about the idea of those things that we're raised with that are intrinsic to us that we don't stop and think about until we are confronted with something that makes us stop and think about them.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. We need to finish up soon, but I have a couple of questions I want to ask you before we go.
Okay.
Firstly, we've kind of talked about belief, which takes us to the next thing, which is death. I'd just like to know if it's a thing that you think about, if it's a thing that you have a theory about what happens, like what your thoughts are on that. And, you know, well, that's the starting point, and then we can see what happens.
Yeah, sure. Let's get into it. I can see that some of my friends, I mean, we talk about it. I can see that people kind of fear death or think about it a lot, or I know that it's there, but it's kind of an abstract concept to me in a way. Like, personally, I'm not afraid of it. It doesn't inform my life. I'm not worried about it. My biggest experience with death so far would have been in 2015. That was actually right before I came to the comedy festival. My mom died in February of 2015, and it was the, you know, biggest death in my life, the biggest grief that I felt. And it's only through going through that, I think, that I understand a little bit about grief and that I solidified these ideas that I maybe didn't have a reason to have before then. I don't know what happens after we die. No one does. I don't spend too much time thinking about it or wondering about it. But I found the idea, like, I love that I'm biologically related to my mom, and I never really thought about it so much before. Right. But the fact that she's gone, but I'm still here and I'm experiencing things, and I have, you know, the things that she taught me and even her DNA, that just feels so great to me in a way that she's kind of still alive or still around. And I just never had a reason to consider that before. So I guess I feel like, yeah, this is intense. I'm looking at a picture of this kind of psychedelic cat you have on your wall over there.
I mean, weirdly enough, that's actually our cat that just passed away.
Oh.
And James Fosdick, who does all my art for my shows and stuff, yeah, just drew that as a little...
Oh, beautiful.
You know, so his name was Ziggy, and so it's kind of like a Ziggy Stardust. He had two different colored eyes, and so James just did that as a nice little... when he died. So
it's so
in my barely decorated house at the moment, I have a couple of pictures of my recently departed
it's so great
up on the wall.
Yeah, and I guess I keep trailing off because I don't want to sound too vague or cheesy, but it's genuinely how I feel. Is I don't think death is an end, you know. And even with a cat, with Ziggy, right, he influenced your life, he changed your life, you think about him. I'm not too disturbed by death.
So when and if you die, what is it that you would hope people remember about you? Or what impact is it that you hope that you might have had, you know, on with this part of whatever our human existence is?
I would hope that people would just remember kind moments that we had together, and people would have a hard time thinking of the time Deanne Smith hurt my feelings, the time Deanne Smith, you know, spoke an unkind word to me or whatever. And I have such a poor memory that I'm lucky that happens to me a little bit in life, where someone will go, 5 years ago, I told you this, and you said this thing to me, and it was amazing. And I'm like, wow, I don't even remember that conversation. You know, I have a really terrible memory. So I don't necessarily have a vision of a grand, not necessarily a grand impact, but if in general, the impact is more positive than negative.
Is there any misconceptions that people have about you? I assume with most people, there's always something that, you know, even if it's not true, that we imagine people think about us that isn't true. Is there anything that fits into that category for you? Do you think there's a wrong impression that people have about any aspect of who you are?
I think so, yeah. And I only through getting feedback from doing comedy, and people only see... For the most part, I mean, that's my public persona, is the stand-up persona. So they only see this one aspect of my personality. But I'm a lot more melancholy than people realize. I'm a lot more introverted than people realize, because those aren't the qualities on display. And one thing I'm worried about that people might think is that I am really bad at communication. I'm really disorganized for whatever reason. I'm sure it's like a bit of anxiety and avoidance coping. But I find out later that I've ignored a message or someone, or it's gone to the hidden folder in Facebook or whatever. So my fear, I guess, is that there's a certain amount of people out there who's like, why is Deanna ignoring me? Or she doesn't like me or something. It's really just like, I'm so disorganized that I probably didn't even get that message.
My phone broke at Christmas.
Oh no.
And so I got a new phone, but it literally didn't even have the backup was all, anyway. So I've been genuinely doing the whole, every time I get a text message from someone, I've had to do the, I have a new phone, who is this? Which, you know, has become the cliche thing that people say to someone that they've, you know, erased from their phone or like, but I've been starting from scratch. And because I've been so busy doing other things, I could have sat down at some stage and like sort of, sent a message to all my Facebook friends or to, you know, like, rung around or found someone to give me official numbers or whatever, but I just haven't because I'm terrible at life. And so there is a few messages that I haven't got back to because I'm just so embarrassed that I'm going to have to write, you know, because they'll be like, oh, it was so great to see your show last night. You know, I love this. Yeah. You're the best. And then you have to go, who is this?
Oh, yeah.
So I can totally relate to that, I must say. Yeah. Hey, we should finish up because, you know, you're at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, then you're at the Sydney Comedy Festival, yes?
Yeah,
or at the
one day, April 24th.
Perth, did you say as well? Where else
Perth
are you?
Perth is, I believe, April 27th. It's a Friday. Just one night in Sydney, one night in Perth, and then I'm out of here.
And then what happens after that for the rest of the year? Well, and where can people, like, you know, the plug bit of it, you know? So if they've...
Oh, right. This part.
If this is the first time, perhaps, that they've, you know, heard you and they've made it this far, that means they want more. That's what I found traditionally.
Oh, sure.
So where is the more? What would you like to direct them to?
I used to have the most passive-aggressive cards in the world. And I thought they were funny. And then I realized, no, this is like another example of me pushing people away. Right. And on one side was a picture of me holding a sign that said jokes. And it said Deanne Smith. Flip it over. And it just said Google it. I have managed to be the most successful Deanne Smith. You can just Google it. And my social stuff is just my name. I think Insta and Twitter is Deanne_Smith.
Yeah. So find you where they are.
I have a website.
I subscribe to that as well. I have a website, but I haven't even, like, somebody messaged me the other day and said, oh, I tried to buy a link for your show and it went to last year's show. And I said, yeah, because I've not updated the website.
Oh, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one that does this.
Because I don't think anyone's going there.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm where you are. If you're on Facebook, look up me on Facebook and I'm there.
Yeah.
If you're on Instagram, look up me on Instagram. I mean, wherever you are, find me there. You don't have to go to some whole new place. You can just stay where you are and look up me there. So they can do that about you as well.
Yes. And I'd like to say this, wherever you are, I'm there in your heart. Just feel me in your heart.
Thank you, mate. It's been brilliant.
Thank you.